From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The governor's building, it looks like a massive open-air refugee camp, many hundreds, perhaps thousands of people sheltering there. Got to see the diocese for the first time. The diocese is completely burnt out, as are many, many buildings in that sector of town.
Alan Nairn, one of the last reporters in East Timor detained by the Indonesian military, will speak to him at the Army's Central Command in Dili. Also, a conversation around the world with observers who were accredited by the UN to monitor the UN referendum in East Timor, all coming home. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton is hoping a peacekeeping force can hit the ground in East Timor within days. He tells reporters he thinks Congress will back his decision approving a limited U.S. role. U.S. officials expect an American contingent numbering in the hundreds, providing airlift, logistics, and intelligence. Australia is expected to be in charge, with Asians providing most of the rest of the troops. Meantime, President Clinton is urging the Indonesian regime not to make a bad situation worse. He's accused Indonesian soldiers of whipping up the anti-independence militias who've been on a rampage in East Timor. Clinton says until the peace force deploys, it's essential Jakarta seek to stop the violence and allow relief workers to get food to the refugees. For more than 23 years, the U.S. administration has been supporting the Indonesian military in its occupation of East Timor. Lawyers from around the world will begin collecting eyewitness testimony about atrocities committed in East Timor for an eventual U.N. war crimes tribunal. This according to a senior judge. Such a court has not yet been established, but it came a step closer to realization yesterday when Mary Robinson, the United Nations top human rights envoy, said Indonesian President B.J. Habibie agreed that those responsible for atrocities in East Timor must be held accountable. Lawyers will begin taking statements from East Timorese refugees, according to Justice John Dowd, the president of the Australian section of the International Commission of Jurists. The testimony would be stored in a database that could be handed to a future UN court. Robinson is pushing for a court to be set up similar to those prosecuting perpetrators of atrocities in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. Meanwhile, the Clinton administration is renewing its campaign to remove Saddam Hussein as Iraq's president. Officials say they're seeking to establish an international tribunal to prosecute him and senior aides as war criminals. There are currently two war crimes tribunals, both set up by the UN, to deal with Bosnia and Rwanda. The effort to oust Saddam comes at the same time as a renewed effort to revive UN inspections in Iraq. A proposal to resume inspections will be taken up tomorrow at a conference in London. Britain and the Netherlands will try to win support for the idea from Russia, China, France, and other nations. Meantime, UN sanctions against Iraq continue to take the lives of, estimates are, something like 5,000 people per month. This news from Pristina. Gunmen fired on a convoy of Serbs returning to their homes in the American sector of Kosovo, killing one and wounding others, this according to NATO. Elsewhere, two Montenegrin women, aged 50 and 70 years, were found dead Monday in their home in the western city of Pesh, the NATO command said, without releasing further details. Since NATO peacekeepers arrived in Kosovo on June 12th, Serbs, Montenegrins, and other non-Albanians have been targeted for reprisal killings by ethnic Albanians seeking revenge for the 18-month crackdown that ended when President Slobodan Milosevic accepted a peace plan to halt NATO's bombing of Yugoslavia. The first wave of aerial and ground spraying of New York City to combat mosquito-borne encephalitis was expected to be completed today. Two more cases of the potentially deadly disease were confirmed. The latest cases, a 15-year-old boy who's been hospitalized and a 38-year-old woman who's been released from a hospital and appears to have recovered, are significantly younger than those previously infected. They brought the total of confirmed cases to 11. Three of those have died. And this news from Illinois, health investigators have been interviewing hundreds of people who attended a September 4th concert and cookout in Springfield, hoping some pattern will emerge to explain an E. coli outbreak that has sickened at least 281 people. All they know for sure is that the people who fell ill were among the people at the event in a cow pasture near Petersburg, Illinois. 20 were sick enough that they had to be hospitalized. E. coli is a bacteria usually found in the intestines or manure of cattle. People who ingest it can suffer severe cramps, bloody diarrhea, and in extreme cases, kidney failure. Americans overseas can get a good idea if Y2K problems by checking out the State Department's website. The department is releasing warnings today about 194 countries, including possible power and water outages and other problems that could be caused by your 2000 computer glitch. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. If the United Nations approves an international force of peacekeepers, Australia could lead troops into East Timor by the weekend. Thousands of Australian troops are on alert in Darwin and could be in the Indonesian... here I am reading from AP, and they're once again calling it the Indonesian province. Again, the United Nations has never approved the annexation of East Timor by Indonesia. So I'll start that again and speak without the bias of AP, Reuters, and the New York Times often annexing East Timor. Thousands of Australian troops are on alert in Darwin and could be in East Timor within hours of UN approval. Defense Minister John Moore says peacekeepers could be there as early as Saturday, but that might be too late, says a spokesperson for the East Timor Independence Movement, who says killings and chaos in the capital of Dili continue. To the echo of sporadic gunfire in the distance, the United Nations closed its besieged compound in East Timor yesterday, flying out 110 staffers and 1,300 Timorese refugees who had become hostage to marauding militia and Indonesian troops. A dozen UN personnel, led by a Bangladeshi brigadier general, stayed behind, holed up in the Australian consulate, which they think is safer with higher walls. They are to prepare the way for an intervention by international peacekeepers. Indonesian Foreign Minister Ali Alatas was in New York yesterday negotiating with UN officials on the makeup of the force. All sorts of news from people inside Timor. Speaking from the area, David Jimenez, a spokesperson for East Timor's independence movement, told Portuguese radio that killings in Dili are continuing. Referring to the arrival of peacekeepers, he said, 3 or 4 more days will be too late. We can't defend ourselves. We are unarmed. The Atlanta-based Carter Center, which monitors international political crises, said militiamen backed by the Indonesian military continue to terrorize and murder refugees in camps set up in West Timor. Well, every day on Democracy Now!, we've tried to bring you live reports from Dili, from one of the reporters there, Alan Nairn. Alan put out a report this past week in The Nation magazine documenting U.S. support for the Indonesian military and militias, saying that this past April, after one of the worst massacres in months in Lekisa, 2 days later, the head of the Pacific Command, Admiral Dennis Blair, met with General Wiranto, the head of the Indonesian Armed Forces. The word out was that he was going to tell him to shut the militias down. But in fact, what Alan was able to prove with secret cables and memos confidential was that what he told Wiranto was that he would probably be getting more military training. It would be resumed and he could hope for even more, and also invited him to Hawaii, which is SINGPAC headquarters. Well, Dennis Blair, the admiral, head of the Pacific Command, supposedly told Waranto this week that the game was up, that U.S. military relations would be broken with Indonesia. And President Clinton also announced that weapons sales would be cut off. Alan Nairn has been reporting from the streets of Dili, East Timor, and continues to do that, even as he has been detained by the Indonesian military. He's been in their custody for almost a day now, and Alan Nairn, just before we went to air, spoke with us. He talked to me and Bernard White on our local show on Pacifica Radio's WBAI about the situation in East Timor, as well as his own. Can you tell us what's happening right now and how you got taken by the military?
Well, this morning I was out on the street and was picked up by soldiers and brought to Koram. And for the rest of the day here, I've been going back and forth between Koram and Polda, the main police base. You could see out on the streets of Dili today that the Aitarak are still riding openly through the streets, Aitarak and military, not much normal civilian traffic. Down by the waterfront area and in front of the governor's office, the main governor's building, it looks like a massive open-air refugee camp, many hundreds, perhaps thousands of people sheltering there. Got to see the diocese for the first time. The diocese is completely burnt out, as are many, many buildings in that sector of town. Here at the Koram main military base, there's a whole group of uniformed Aitarak in the back. So you have uniformed soldiers and uniformed Aitarak operating out of here, going out on their motorcycles and their vans to do their raids. And it was the same story at the Polda base.
Alan, for listeners who aren't familiar, Alan, Aitarak, explain what it is.
Aitarak is the main Dili militia, which is ostensibly independent, but which is obviously an arm of the military. This is the base run by General Kiki Shianakri, who briefly spoke to me this morning. He's the overall commander of Timor. He's head of the martial law authority, the authority for the restoration of peace and stability in Timor. And it's out of his base that the Aitarak are going out and doing their raids. And another interesting thing, at the Polda police headquarters, although the Aitarak were there and, you know, working with the police going out, the police intel people were busy, even as they were questioning me, burning documents. Because as one of my interrogators said, well, you know, Timor is about to be free. It's about to become a free country. And he said that they were about to leave and would be packing up the base and moving to Kupang in Indonesia. And they had a bonfire going outside where they were tossing in these red binders full of intel documents. So at least they are, you know, that police intelligence unit is planning to evacuate very soon.
I wonder, Alan, if that has anything to do with this growing call for a war crimes tribunal around what Indonesia has done in Timor. In fact, there's a piece in the New York Times today that says that even President B.J. Habibie has agreed to the creation of an international commission to investigate possible atrocities in East Timor. This, according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Mary Robinson said he'd accepted her proposal for Indonesian and foreign officials to join in a commission of inquiry, a commission of experts to look at the evidence of human rights violations.
Well, I expect that Habibie's agreement to that commission will be in the same sense that he agreed to an investigation of Suharto corruption. I think it's not going to happen unless and until the power of the army is broken in Indonesia and you start to get a real democratic government. That hasn't happened yet, but there is a grassroots democracy movement in Indonesia, and I think it's possible that this Timor crisis, which has really put the army on the spot internationally, exposed the civilian presidency of Indonesia as a sham, this could end up really damaging the army. If the democracy movement takes advantage of this and moves aggressively against the army in the coming weeks.
Alan, we were just trying to call you, and it was busy. Well, sometimes it's just impossible to get through, but I understand you just got a call from José Ramos Horta, the Nobel Peace Prize winner of Timor.
Right, and actually José was calling from New York. He said, well, I asked him about his meeting with Clinton, I guess the other day, and he said that Clinton gave support for a massive airlift of food into Timor. He said that Clinton told him that the Indonesian government won't be able to dictate the composition of this so-called peacekeeping force that will be coming in, and that the force ought to come in immediately, that the U.S. will pour money into the economic reconstruction of Timor. José said that he asked, or he said to Clinton, that the U.S. military aid and relations cutoff for Indonesia has to be long-term. It has to be clear that it's a long-term cutoff, and that it should be in place until there is fundamental change in the Indonesian armed forces. And I asked him how Clinton responded to that, and he said, well, he took notes and reacted well. And from having heard accounts of how Clinton responds to proposals, I take that as a no. Giving the impression of support, but not really supporting. But it's interesting that Ramos Horta is finally getting that kind of access after Clinton, after he won the Nobel Peace Prize. Clinton just brushed him off and refused to meet with him. Speaking of the Peace Force, a little while ago, one of the people they sent in to interrogate me here at the Corum was a Kopassus man. Those are the special forces that you know, they specialize in torture and the disappearances. And he was from Group 5, the most elite part of Kopassus, the so-called anti-terrorist force. They've been extensively trained by the Pentagon and U.S. intelligence. And I asked him what exactly he did in Timor. And he said, well, I guess you could say I'm from the Indonesian peacekeeping force in Timor. And he started to laugh, you know, uproariously.
Alan, could you just describe to us a little bit about how that interrogation went? Just what kind of questions did they ask you, and then what was the tone?
Well, it actually hasn't gotten that deep yet compared to others in the past. You know, they've just been asking basic things so far, but, you know, why are you here? What are you doing? What are you up to? Trying to figure out my exact movements and contact and so on, but we'll see. I mean, they've told me there's a lot more to come. It hasn't really gotten rolling yet.
Alan, what are they telling you about what's going to happen to you?
Well, it keeps changing. The latest they're saying now is that tomorrow, you know, local time, it's now evening here in Delhi, that I'll be put on a military plane and flown to Kupang in West Timor, Indonesia, and then from there, maybe to Bali, maybe to Jakarta, and then perhaps be put out of the country, although they've said that it may be questioned by various people along the way, various stops along the way.
Alan, it has just been revealed that the UN last night actually did leave East Timor under cover of darkness with more than 1,000 refugees. Can you talk about the significance of even the skeletal crew that was left actually leaving? I think it said something like a dozen United Nations staff remained in Timor, but they moved to the Australian mission or building there that has higher walls and more security.
Right. Well, it's good that they were able to get the internal refugees out of the UN compound. On the other hand, this is yet another cutback in the U.N. presence in Timor. It's down to almost nothing now. Some others are starting to come in. The International Red Cross is now being able to make flights, and they're going to be doing daily flights in to deliver some supplies and start to get their operations rolling again after their office was sacked and burnt by the military and the militias a number of days ago. It's very important in these next few days that as much of an international presence as possible be maintained on the streets of Delhi, and especially in the rural towns, because you can only imagine what's happening there. It's bad enough in Delhi.
Alan, you were taken back and forth from Kodam to Polda, which is the police station. You actually had been brought to the police station before last week, and describe that. Can you tell us what happened there the first time? In fact, it was militia that first brought you there, once again underscoring the relationship between the militia and the Indonesian military.
Yeah, well, they sure looked like militia. They were plain clothes, young men with... one with a Mauser rifle, the other with a 38. The one with the 38 was drunk. They called him the commander. Behind him was this little row of guys in black Atark T-shirts with long hair and AK-47 slung over their shoulders. And, you know, it had all the looks of a militia operation, and they were very, very menacing. They came into a house that I was in. And, you know, there were some pretty rough moments there. It looked like we might be in real trouble. But managed to talk to them in a way that it confused them a bit and slowed them down. And they ended up getting on the walkie-talkie and calling their commander. And then a minute or two later, the commander comes striding through the door, and he's in full police colonel's uniform with his hat and his epaulets. It's Colonel Sitomping, Sitompil, who I later learned from foreign officials who were well informed about his activities. He's actually a military intel man who uses the police to run covert operations. And you know, in this case, there's a particular militia crew that he was running. And one of the things I saw in being driven around today was that particular neighborhood that I was picked up in by Sitompul's militiamen, much of it is burnt to a crisp now. I don't know whether the particular house I was I was in is gone. I didn't get close enough to see that, but a lot of the surrounding neighborhood is gone.
Alan Nairn speaking to us from Kodam, which is the Army command post for all of East Timor. He is being detained by the Indonesian military. When we come back, we'll ask him how it is that he can speak to us through this detention, and also get his reaction to a New York Times piece today, U.S. to Jakarta Messenger, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, talking about how Hugh Shelton, who was speaking with Wiranto, the armed forces chief, throughout the last weeks, ask him about his comments that he couldn't have done it if the U.S. hadn't given aid. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rule. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk to American journalist Alan Nairn, detained by Indonesian military, and not clear what will happen, though it does look like they're going to be shipping him out of East Timor in the next hours, perhaps at the end of the day. Alan, you can't see this, but I'm looking at a piece in the New York Times today by Elizabeth Becker, U.S. to Jakarta Messenger, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And it's a very laudatory piece of the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Henry Shelton. It says, as the violence in and Timor worsen, the Americans relied on one person to deliver a tough message to the Indonesian government, this according to senior administration officials. And it says as Washington shifted from resisting sanctions to making a serious threat to the Indonesian economy, General Shelton relayed the increasingly urgent messages that the Indonesian army had to end the killings and destruction in East Timor. That message was underlined by Admiral Dennis Blair, commander-in-chief of the Pacific Command, who traveled to Jakarta. Then it goes on to say, now the Pentagon is beginning preparations to provide logistical support, about 150 American troops, to work on communications, supplies, and intelligence for a multinational mission for East Timor. And the administration is arguing that the channel to the Indonesian military speaks to the value of the years of training given to Indonesia's future military leaders in the United States and the millions of dollars in military aid for Indonesia. A senior administration official said it was a big plus to have someone who could call the Indonesian military. They were the ones calling the shots. We had a unique asset, and I don't see how our military could have done it without their past history with these generals. And it goes on from there. Your response after exposing the U.S. support for the Indonesian military and the militias. You told a different story about Admiral Dennis Blair, head of the Pacific Command.
So the, don't see how we could have done it. How we could have done what? I mean, I guess he's saying, I don't see how we could have trained all those Indonesian officers without having trained all those Indonesian officers. You know, if all you have to do is think about the argument that's being made there. I mean, here they're saying this is a force that is doing mass killing. And it's wonderful that we've given them all this assistance and training over the years, because they claim it gives them it gives some leverage. It's not support is support. The Indonesian military sees that. And when Blair was sent in after the Likisa massacre in April, with the mission of telling Wiranto to shut the militias down, he didn't do that. He, in fact, offered more support, and that led to a dramatic increase in the militia terror and really helped to bring the situation to where it is now.
I also have to say, Alan, that there is no mention of Dennis Blair, the admiral, and the expose you did on him delivering a very different message. And this is a piece you did in The Nation this past week. No mention of it in the New York Times. Well, last question, and that is, as we talk about the brutality of the Indonesian regime, how is it that you're talking to us in a cell phone from Army headquarters as you are being detained by the Indonesian military?
Well, because I'm an American citizen, because I'm a journalist, because I'm kind of in a notorious political case here, you know, there's a certain... they don't do the interrogation in the way they would do it if it were an Indonesian dissident or a Timorese. This morning, it's, you know, it's done with kid gloves. This morning, and the police, being questioned by the police intel man, on his desk, he had a screwdriver and a knife. And, you know, they could have been there for innocent reasons, but there's something about the setting that made me think they weren't. And, in fact, one of his aides, one of the intel man's aides, as he started to question me, quickly removed the screwdriver and the knife from the desk. You know, they work, they take the Timorese and work them over very hard, electroshock, slicing with blades, all sorts of horrible things. This is routine. But I can get away with a lot more because I'm a foreigner, especially because I'm an American.
Well, Alan, I hope that you take care of yourself in these next hours, and we will continue to be in contact with you throughout the day. Please take care.
Okay, thanks.
Alan Nairn reporting to us from the CODEM Army Command Headquarters. CODEM is in charge of East Timor, And there it is that the general, who is in charge of martial law, has his offices. Alan Nairn has continually defied the Indonesian military, having been banned from there in 1991 after surviving the Dili massacre, where more than 250 Timorese were killed. Alan and I went to East Timor in 1990, 91, as a result of that massacre, Alan had his skull fractured by the Indonesian soldiers who beat him over the head with their US M-16s. We went back in 1994 to cover Clinton going to the APEC summit. Later learned he was also meeting with his campaign contributors in Indonesia, like the Riyadis. We were arrested then as we tried to get into Timor, but we did actually get in a few days later, slipped in, and learned from a resistance leader that the torture most commonly used at that time was forcing the Timorese to swallow their crucifixes and applying electroshock to their genitals. Alan returned in 1997, where he held a news conference exposing once again U.S. military documents that showed that despite a congressional ban, that the Pentagon was training the elite Kopassus troops, the Red Berets, in sniper technique and other methods against the people of Indonesia and East Timor, and they were being trained by U.S. Green Berets. He was deported for that, also threatened with 6 years in prison, and now Alan has slipped in again under the army ban, and has been in Indonesia for the last 4 months and East Timor for the last few weeks, now being interrogated at army headquarters, and we will keep you posted. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue to deal with East Timor, this is the United Nations is preparing to send in a peacekeeping force that will probably be led by Australia. Ali Alatas, the foreign minister of Indonesia, in New York, negotiating on this peacekeeping force with Kofi Annan, the secretary general. But what we're going to talk about now is what happened in these weeks leading up to the referendum and the time afterwards with the terrible violence that has taken place in Timor. Not a surprise to many, certainly not to Timorese, though it is a surprise that they were willing to do it in front of Westerners. We're joined right now by Westerners from around the world who are part of a very unusual operation called IFET, and that is the International Federation for East Timor Observer Project. The UN accredited observers from around the world to go to all the villages and towns, or many of them, of East Timor to make sure that the referendum that would take place on August 30th would be free and fair. We're joined in the studio right now by two people who have just returned, were forced out of East Timor by the militia violence, but were there for the referendum and observing that. Charlie Shiner was the international coordinator of the IFET project, and we're joined by Jill Sternberg, who is with Peace Brigades International, sends peace teams all over the world, and was a part of the IFET project. In Australia, Darwin, we turn to Pam Sexton, who was also a part of that project. While Jill and Charlie were in Dili, the capital, Pam was sent out to Swai. And in the last few days, we've heard terrible, terrible stories out of Swai, where another massacre took place just this past week. We welcome you all to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, why don't we begin with Charlie? You were the international coordinator of the project. Tell us just very quickly how this came about, and then the highlights of what you are thinking about now, the images you return with from East Timor.
Well, beginning in April and May of this year, as the negotiations were proceeding to have the UN-sponsored referendum in East Timor, which took place last August, many of us who had been working on East Timor around the world for many years felt that there was a need for an independent presence there, that although we thought the intentions of the UN were good, we certainly didn't trust the Indonesian military and militias, and we didn't feel that the process would necessarily be free and fair. From the very beginning, the fact that the Indonesian military was given responsibility for security in East Timor was a fundamental flaw, and IFET, the International Federation for East Timor, said that over and over again to the UN Security Council, to the Secretary General, to the media throughout the spring. And we decided that it would be more effective, give more weight to our voice, and provide a bridge between the East Timorese people and the UN and the international community if we actually sent people to East Timor. So from June on, we sent a total of 125 volunteers from 22 countries. We had teams in all of East Timor's 13 districts on Election Day, and we published 8 reports and numerous other media releases throughout the course of the consultation. It's a little bit, I don't know, I hate to be saying I told you so in this situation, but in almost every one of our reports, we reported that the East Timorese feared a massive crackdown by the militias and the militaries after the result of the vote was announced, because everyone in East Timor felt that and knew that and had been told that. The fact that they came out to vote in such huge numbers and that they voted overwhelmingly for independence shows that the intimidation didn't work, but it doesn't mean that the fears weren't real. And so I'm appalled by the fact that the UN didn't have any planning, even though the UN people in East Timor, what they called UNAMET, the UN Assistance Mission in East Timor, was very aware of these threats and of this possibility. The UN Security Council here in New York, the political people in New York, the Secretary General, had no contingency plans for what has happened in the last week and a half since the result of the vote is announced. I guess the observer, our observer task is unfortunately terminated early. We had hoped to continue to stay in East Timor to monitor what happened after the results of the referendum. But with the increasing violence and increasing pressure from our own governments, the last of our observers was evacuated from Baucau a week ago today. Jill and I were evacuated from Dili the day before that, Monday a week ago.
I remember watching CNN a number of days ago, about a week ago, and while I didn't see you, Charlie, they showed a picture of a tape recorder, and they had a very brief interview with you as you were speaking right before you left and had to get out of the way of some gunfire that was coming in.
Yeah, actually, there's a funny twist on that story. During that day, that last Monday, this is 2 days after the result of the vote was announced, we were pretty much confined to our office in Dili, but we were receiving phone calls from around East Timor. The phone system at that time was still working, at least in Dili, reports of things that were happening, and lots of calls from the media, because almost all the international media had already left East Timor, so we were about the only on-site information they could get. And there was gunfire, as there had been for most of the previous week, sporadic gunfire at night, and then it began in the daytime, and then it began more and more close to our office. The phones in our office were close to the front of the building, and the gunfire mostly came from the street, so that when we heard gunfire, we would go into the back. And I was doing this interview, actually, with British radio, and the gunfire started getting louder and louder, and I first went under the desk, and I was describing it, and they could hear the gunfire, I guess, over the phone. And then as it got even closer, I said, I'm going to hang up the phone now, and I went into the back of the building. It turned out that that gunfire was actually from the police who were coming to escort us to the airport. It was not from the militias, as most of the other gunfire would be.
Jill Sternberg, as you return from this both historic referendum where more than three-quarters of the population voted for independence from Indonesia, can you talk about what your most vivid impressions of the time were? But first, start off with you leaving in the convoy to the airport and what that was like.
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that we were most concerned about in that convoy was the fact that we were taking the vehicles that we had rented from Timorese to the airport to leave them there, because the Australian government who was evacuating us would not come to pick us up at our house. So we had to provide our own transportation to the airport. We had heard some gruesome stories about the roads on the way to the airport, and so we were trying to watch out the windows of the vehicles. At the same time, we were concerned that there might be gunfire at the vehicles. But what we saw was hundreds of refugees along the road, people just standing on the side of the road with some belongings, desperate to get out of East Timor, and at the same time, vehicles full of militia driving around and shooting gunfire, and so it was a very gruesome scene. At the same time, I didn't feel personally that we were under any direct threat. It was very clear to us that it wasn't us that was the target.
Did everyone make it out in your convoy?
Yeah. Actually, no. We had one Timorese staff person with us who wanted to try to leave East Timor via the airport, and we tried very desperately to get him on the flight with us, but the Australians who evacuated us would not even accept one East Timorese on that flight.
What did they say? I mean, clearly they faced clear danger if they were trying to get out and even were further marked and were stopped at the airport.
Yeah. Basically, the Australians at the airport insisted that there would be an international incident at the airport if they allowed him on the plane.
Have you heard from him since?
No. We're hoping that he got out with the UN people that got out yesterday, but we don't know that.
Again, the United Nations leaving almost completely from East Timor at this point, under cover of night, also bringing out 1,300 refugees to Darwin, Australia. Now a tiny team left, hunkered down at the Australian consulate building in East Timor, which they felt was the safest. And let's not forget, though, in terms of being hunkered down, that it looks like at this point hundreds of thousands of Timorese are in the mountains. It's not clear how hungry they are. We know they're very thirsty because this is the dry season. And many Timorese leaders are calling for an immediate airlift to seek to get some kind of relief to those people who've been forced from their homes all over Timor. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back with our guests in just a second. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests today, Charlie Shiner and Jill Sternberg, who have just returned from East Timor, part of an international force of grassroots activists and observers accredited by the United Nations to monitor the historic referendum that took place on August 30th, where more than three-quarters of the population of Timor voted for independence. But what led up to that vote and what has followed has been horrendous, a level of carnage in East Timor that is clearly visible to everyone. And for the first time, though, international journalists were there to confirm what the Timorese have been saying, crying out about for so many years, a third of the population killed since Indonesia invaded East Timor in 1975. 90% of the weapons the army used to invade were from the United States. In addition to Jill Sternberg and Charlie Shiner, we're joined on the phone now from Darwin, Australia, by Pam Sexton, who is one of those international observers also cleared out to Darwin. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Pam.
Thank you, Amy.
Pam, in the last few days, while we've seen nothing like the coverage of what happened to the Kosovar Albanians as they crossed the border, for example, into Macedonia, with hundreds of reporters meeting them to hear their stories, we did get a very powerful story on the front page of the Washington Post on Saturday, photograph of a nun weeping as she told the story of escaping from Swai and a massacre that took place last Monday. It began something like, and I don't have it in front of me, but Father Duanto was the first to die, said the nun. And it talked about how, fully in his cloaks, his priest's garb, he walked out of the compound and the militia gunfire cut him down. The second priest then came out of the compound. He, too, shot dead in front of horrified women, children, their infants in a compound who had taken protection, gone to the church compound because they felt that's where they would be safest. Four of those women in labor but wanted to be near the priests because they thought that would be their only protection. And then the militiamen went into the church, went into the church offices, and there the senior priest, Father Hilario, was, and they cut him down with automatic gunfire. They then went to where the women were. They sprayed them with gunfire and then threw in grenades and killed them all. Pam, you were there in the weeks before that. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, just as Charlie said, and this wasn't something that we didn't have warning about. I was in Swai actually for only about 10 days. I was there for the observation of the vote and more than a week before then. And in the days after the vote, our team was asked to come into Dili because the level of intimidation was getting so extreme, and we were being told again and again that the roads between Swai and the capital were being closed off by militias. In the time that I was in Swai, we spent a lot of time in and around this church, and we had daily meetings with Father Hilario, Father Francisco, and with people inside the church. And to get an image, most of the refugees in Swai, about half of the refugees, that's about 3,000 refugees out of 6,000, were huddled together inside this half-built church that has, it's incomplete, and they've put up different things, bricks and plastic to keep the wind out, and they're all huddled in there together. There was always a great deal of intimidation and threat around the church. The militia, when they were going around, they would always go toward the church and yell things at the people in the church. I heard threats on several occasions where they would go right into the church compound and say that if they voted for independence, they would all be killed. And in the time that we were there, we spent a great deal of time around there, knowing that there were severe threats to the people there. And to hear this story, I feel like, in a way, we've been part of this tragic play that the Indonesian military has put on, and they very successfully got rid of the witnesses. They got rid of the international presence. I've heard reports in Swai District of between 100 and 900 people being killed just in the last week, and I've tried daily to call contacts that I have in Swai, and none of the phone lines are able to go through. I've spent a lot of the last few days meeting with the people who've worked with the UN and their families who've been airlifted out with the United Nations and are now in Darwin, and we've been trying to find out where our local staff are and if they're safe, and also meet up with people we know. And there's this huge sense of no one knows who's alive or who's dead, and the exact numbers are extremely hard to know. But all of this was predicted, and in our reports, we had daily reports. Daily people came to us and told us of atrocities that they had witnessed, of people who were being disappeared, of the collusion between the military, the police, and the militias. And all of these reports were going to the UN. They were going out to the international community. And I'm stunned and outraged that we're still waiting for the international community to respond to this, that we're waiting on Indonesia, who has really planned this whole, what's becoming an annihilation of a people.
We're talking to Pam Sexton, who is from Watsonville, California, who went to East Timor to observe a historic election and left there and has seen what she has just described. We're also joined on the phone by John Roussa. He, too, was part of the IFET project, the International Federation for East Timor Observer Project. And John was caught in a Timorese human rights organization's offices with a number of other Timorese. John, can you tell us what happened?
Yeah. Well, there were about 40 of us inside the building in downtown Dili, and we had expected some sort of an attack, and indeed it came on the night of the 5th. They fired into the building for about an hour, and all of us inside laid on the floor and lay quiet in the dark and pretended as if there was no one in the building. And after about an hour of heavy firing and breaking nearly all the windows, they went away. After about another hour after that, the police came to evacuate only the foreigners, myself and a British fellow. They eventually agreed to evacuate all of us to the police station, about 10 Indonesians and the rest East Timorese. And as we were being escorted out into the police truck, the militia was there, right behind the police, waving and cheering their guns in the air. And as we left, they entered the building to burn and loot it.
John, I want to go back for a minute as to how you got out and what role the U.S. government played.
Well, when the attack began, IFET called up the embassy, and the embassy made a call to the police in East Timor, and especially to the UNIMET liaison officer. And with the calls being made also from the Australian consulate and from other offices of UNIMET, the police did respond. And when the police came, they said that they would not have come if it hadn't been for that call from the U.S. Embassy. And all of the police officers, Indonesian police officers, were very apprehensive about my safety. And it was as if they had received an order from a master, and they were very worried about anything happening to me and their master being disappointed.
Did they try to take only you out?
Yes, initially they only came to take me and the British person out, and they were going to leave everyone else there to be attacked again by the militia.
What did you do?
Well, we made the decision either all of us stay or all of us go. And the decision was that all of us were going to go because we thought if we stayed, the police are only going to leave and go and tell the militia exactly who's inside. And there were several people there who had prices on their head. And the militia would have been more than happy to know that precisely those people were inside. And they would be happy to know exactly how the building was laid out. And there was no guarantee that they would not attack again just because there was an American and a British person there, especially after the police told them that those two foreigners refused an escort out. We became a kind of fair game at that point. So the expectation was that the militia would attack again, and this time enter the building and really try to kill us. So we decided to all evacuate.
John Roussa speaking to us from abroad. John, having survived this militia attack along with 40 others, and perhaps the 40 others would not have survived if it weren't for John's connections to the U.S. Embassy as a U.S. citizen. This master relationship between the U.S. government and the Indonesian government. Charlie Shiner is international coordinator of IFET, the International Federation of East Timor. It seems the corporate press is going back and forth now, much more press on East Timor, and sometimes they really are describing the terror. But a lot of times the headlines are like those in the New York Times this past weekend. Jakarta concedes it's out of control. The militias are out of control. What did you see on the ground in terms of the militia-military relationship?
The militia-military relationship is it's a tautology. I mean, from almost the first day I got to East Timor, which was in the middle of August, you'd see trucks driving around the streets with militia members. And just about every time if I was standing next to an East Timorese person and one of these trucks went by, they would point to the truck and say, "I know that person, he's Kapasos," or "I know that person, he's TNI." They were
TNI being
the armed forces of Indonesia.
Kapasos, the elite troops.
Right. So that it was basically a change of uniform that, I mean, some of the militias were not this way, but the militia, most active people in terms of inflicting atrocities, in terms of terrorizing people, were soldiers wearing militia uniforms. We had, IFET had a team in Same, one of the cities in the southern part of East Timor, which had a radio and could listen in on the radio communications between the military and the militias. And they heard many times the military officers giving direct orders to the militias, go to this place, stop this car, arrest these people or attack these people. It was, the militias were just as if they were troops in the military, and they followed orders very directly.
In fact, this morning the BBC played some of those radio communications and had those translated as the military gave the militia commands. But it goes higher than that, sort of like what John Russo was describing, and that has to go up to the U.S. and Australian governments, because the U.S. Monitors all communications that go on in Timor from their satellites in Australia.
Yeah, I think it's also very clear the fact that not one single foreigner has been killed during the time that there were thousands of foreigners in East Timor at the time of the vote between the UN people, the observers, the journalists. Now there are hardly any. But huge numbers of East Timorese were killed. Huge numbers more were seriously injured. The total number of foreigners injured is what you could count on one hand. They were clearly under instructions, under orders to intimidate us, to try to get us out of the country, but not to harm us.
Last question on the issue of the United Nations in this period right now. The United Nations is almost completely out of East Timor. The peacekeepers have not yet moved in. It sounds like more than a half of the population, hundreds of thousands of peoples, have been forcibly deported to West Timor, where militias are rampaging through those camps. Hundreds of thousands of people in the mountains. Charlie, what about this period?
It's incredibly dangerous. There are no international observers. I got a call yesterday from a West Timorese. This is an Indonesian who lives in West Timor who has a brother. The person who called me was in the U.S., but he has a brother who lives in Kupang in West Timor. And his brother had called him to say that everybody here thinks that there's a scorched earth policy, that the Indonesian military and militias are going to destroy everything in East Timor in the time before the international peacekeeping force comes. So when I see a headline in today's New York Times, UN moves fast to organize peacekeepers for East Timor, and they're talking about getting people in 3 or 4 days, thousands, tens of thousands of people may be murdered in those 3 or 4 days, and nobody will be there to watch.
I'm going to give Pam Sexton the last word in Australia, as the UN has been fiercely criticized by people as more and more reports of massacres and killings come out and massive deportations and uprootings. The Secretary General has defended himself, saying, but the referendum did take place and it was historic and the people had a say. What do you say to that?
I say we're not backing that up with any action. And exactly what Charlie said, that a few days they're taking, what, 3 to 7 days to negotiate. This is, people are dying daily. And when we listened to the announcement that Habibi was giving consent to some kind of force, but details to be worked out, we sat here thinking that this could be the new green light to mass murder. And we've been seeing murder, we've been seeing absolute terrorization of the population, these mass evacuations, but these next few days they could do an incredible more amount of damage.
I want to,
and it really is a systematic genocide that's going on.
Pam Sexton, thank you for joining us from Darwin. John Russa from abroad, Charlie Shiner and Jill Sternberg from here in New York, all coming out of East Timor after the referendum. That does it for today's show. David Love and Donna Neiman produced the show. Errol Maitland, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. To bury your story.